although at a few of the desks sat Japanese, British, French, and even an Argentine, with a Russian by the side of each one of them. The men and women of the Mission Control Center were just starting to celebrate. Up to the moment of touchdown, they had been rigidly intent on their display screens, but now, at last, they could lean back, slip off their headsets, laugh together, sip champagne, and light up victory cigars. Even some of the women took cigars. Behind the rows of consoles, in the glassed-in media section, reporters and photographers toasted one another, and the mission controllers with vodka in paper cups. Only the chief of the American team, a burly, balding man in his shirt sleeves, sweat stains at his armpits, unlit cigar clamped between his teeth, looked unhappy. He leaned over the chair of the American woman who bore the archaic title of Capcom.
"What did he say?"
She glanced up from her display screens. "I don't know what it was."
"It sure as hell wasn't what he was supposed to say."
"Would you like to replay the tape?"
asked the Russian, working beside the young woman. His voice was soft, but it cut through the buzz of conversation. The woman deftly tapped a few buttons on her keyboard, and the screen once again showed the figure of James Waterman standing in his sky-blue pressure suit on the sands of Mars.
"Yate,"
said Jimmy Waterman's image.
"Garbled transmission?" the chief asked.
"No way," said the woman. The Russian turned from the screen to give the chief a piercing look.
"What does it mean?"
"Damned if I know," grumbled the chief, "but we're sure as hell going to find out."
Up in the media section, one young TV reporter noticed the two men hunched over the Capcom seat. He wondered why they looked so puzzled. Berkeley. Professor Jerome Waterman and Professor Lucille Monroe Waterman had canceled their classes for the day and remained at home to watch their son step out onto the surface of Mars. No friends, no students or faculty colleagues. A battalion of reporters hovered outside the house, but the Watermans would not face them until after they had seen the landing. They sat in their comfortably rumpled, book-lined study, watching the television pictures, window blinds closed tightly against the bright morning sun and the besieging media reporters encamped outside. "It takes almost 10 minutes for the signals to reach the Earth," mused Jerry Waterman. His wife nodded absently, her eyes focused on the sky-blue figure among the 6 faceless creatures on the screen. She held her breath when it was Jamie's turn at last to speak.
"Yate,"
said her son.
Lucille gasped, "Oh, no!"
Jamie's father grunted with surprise. Lucille turned accusingly to her husband.
"He's starting that Indian business all over again."
Santa Fe. Old Al always knew how to pack the store with customers, even on a day like this. He had simply put a TV set prominently up on a shelf next to the Kachina dolls. People thronged in from all over the plaza to see Al's grandson on Mars.
"Yate,"
said Jamie Waterman from 100 million kilometers away.
"Hee-ya!"
exclaimed old Al Waterman.
"The boy did it!"
Data Bank. Mars. Picture Death Valley at its worst. Barren desert, nothing but rock and sand. Remove every trace of life. Get rid of each and every cactus, every bit of scrub, all the lizards and insects and sun-bleached bones and anything else that even looks as if it might have once been alive. Now, freeze-dry the whole landscape. Plunge it down to a temperature of 100 below zero and suck away the air until there's not even as much as you would find on Earth 100,000 feet above the ground. That is roughly what Mars is like. Fourth planet out from the sun, Mars never gets closer to the Earth than 35 million miles. It is a small world, roughly half the diameter of ours, with a surface gravity just a bit more than a third of Earth's. 100 pounds on Earth weighs only 38 pounds on Mars. Mars is known as the Red Planet because its surface is mainly a bone-dry desert of sandy iron oxides, rusty iron dust. Yet there is water on Mars. The planet has bright polar caps, composed at least partially of frozen water, covered over most of the year by frozen carbon dioxide, dry ice.
for Mars is a cold world. It orbits roughly 1.5 times farther from the Sun than the Earth does. Its atmosphere is far too thin to retain solar heat. On a clear midsummer day along the Martian equator, the afternoon high temperature might climb to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. That same night, however, it will plunge to 100 below zero or lower. The atmosphere of Mars is too thin to breathe, even if it were pure oxygen, which it is not. More than 95% of the Martian air is carbon dioxide, nearly 3% nitrogen. There is a tiny amount of oxygen and even less water vapor. The rest of the atmosphere consists of inert gases, such as argon, neon, and such, a whiff of carbon monoxide, and a trace of ozone. Still, Mars is the most Earth-like of any other world in the solar system. There are seasons on Mars: spring, summer, autumn, and winter. Because its orbit is farther from the Sun, the Martian year is nearly twice as long as Earth's, a few minutes short of 689 Earth days, and its seasons are correspondingly much longer than Earth's. Mars rotates about its axis in almost the same time that Earth does. A day on Earth is 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.09 seconds long. A day on Mars is only slightly longer, 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 22.7 seconds. To avoid confusion, space explorers refer to the Martian day as a sol. In one Martian year, there are 669 sols, plus an untidy 14 hours, 46 minutes, and 12 seconds. Is there life on Mars? That question has haunted the human psyche for centuries. It is the primary force behind our drive to reach the Red Planet. We want to see for ourselves if life can exist there, or once did, or does now. Sol 1, Afternoon. The first thing the scientists did after their little arrival speeches was collect contingency samples of the Martian rocks, soil, and atmosphere, just in case a sudden emergency forced them to scramble into their landing ascent vehicle and blast back into orbit around the planet. They spent their first 2 hours on the surface stuffing rocks and soil samples into airtight cases and filling vials with whiffs of air taken from ground level on up to 10 meters, the latter obtained with the use of a gangling titanium pole. Meanwhile, the construction robot trundled across the rocky ground out to the three unmanned cargo carriers that had landed a previous day, scattered over a 2-kilometer-wide radius from their nominal landing site. Like an oversized mechanical ant, the robot busily hauled their cargoes back to the inflated dome that would be home to the explorers for the next 8 weeks. Mikhail Andreevich Voznesensky, veteran of a dozen space missions, sat up in the cockpit in the commander's seat, one eye on the scientists and the other on the mission schedule. Beside him, Pete Connors monitored the robot and conversed with the expedition command in orbit around the planet. Although both men stayed in their hard suits, ready to dash outside if an emergency required their help, they had taken their helmets off. Connors switched off the radio and turned to the Russian. "The guys in orbit confirmed that we landed only 130 meters from our nominal target spot. They send their congratulations." Voznesensky offered a rare smile. "It would have been closer, but the boulders were too big farther south." "You did a damned good job," said Connors. "Kaliningrad will be pleased." His voice was a rich baritone, trained in church choirs. The American had a long, almost horsey face with a complexion the color of milk chocolate and large, sorrowful brown eyes rimmed with red. His hair was cropped militarily short, showing the distinct V of a widow's peak. "You know what the old pilots say," Voznesensky replied. Connors chuckled. "Any landing you can walk away from is a good landing." "All systems are working. We are on schedule." It was Voznesensky's way of making light of his skillful landing. The Russian did not trust flattery, even from a man he had worked with for nearly 4 years. A scowl was the normal expression on his broad, beefy face. His sky-blue eyes always looked suspicious. "Yeah,